Hi, I'm Spencer.
And I'm Andrew.
And we're here at the Slowdown's New York headquarters. You're listening to Time Sensitive, a podcast where we profile curious and courageous people in business, the arts, and beyond who have found a distinct perspective on time.
Welcome to Time Sensitive. On this episode, Spencer's in conversation with former model, advocate, and fashion industry visionary, Bethann Hardison. She is also Gucci's executive advisor for global equity and cultural engagement. What did you guys get into?
So Bethann's someone who has become not only a sort of matriarch in the fashion industry, she's someone who is really living her best life. And that's saying a lot because she really has had a remarkable life.
Yeah. I mean, she has traversed an incredible moment of culture and created a lot of change. I guess she came up as a model.
Yeah. I mean, the simple version is that she was a model and producer in the 70s after working in the garment district the decade before. And this was alongside Pat Cleveland and Iman, who's her best friend. During this time, she collaborated with fashion designers like Willie Smith and Issey Miyake. In the 80s, she built this really path-breaking talent and model agency. She represented and built the careers of icons like Naomi Campbell and Tyson Beckford.
Right.
And throughout, she has pushed for and in turn made change in the world of fashion in terms of representation, from advertising campaigns to editorial shoots to runway shows. I mean, she's someone who's just so full of wisdom and experience. I couldn't help but just think about the word wisdom the whole time I was sitting with her. And she has all these incredible stories, many of which she shares here. In some ways, the episode is a preview of more stories to come because she's also working on a documentary about her path in fashion and also a memoir.
Amazing. I'm really looking forward to listening to it. I'm such a fan of hers. Before we get into it, we'd first like to thank our season 5 sponsor, Le Col School of Jewelry Arts, which is supported by the Maison Van Cleef and Arpels. Since its founding in 2012, Le Col has created an incredible wealth of knowledge around the jewelry arts through its courses, conversations, exhibitions, and many other offerings. Le Col's next in-person conversation, The Art of Brooches, will take place on Tuesday, June 7th from 6:30 to 7:30 p.m., live at the Morgan Library and Museum in New York City.
A conversation between the art historians and jewelry specialist Gislan Okerman and Beatrice Del Favro. The talk will focus on the history of brooches, which in many ways reflect humanity's social and technological evolutions. Okerman and Del Favro will discuss remarkable examples that suggest how certain utilitarian and functional aspects of brooches during antiquity were lost in favor of a more ornamental role. Decorated with precious stones, brooches came to express the wealth and power of their wearers. The talk will also explore the uses of brooches as military badges, as signs of love and devotion, as personal expressions, or simply for glamour.
Ultimately, the Art of Brooches conversation serves as a crash course in how brooches across time hold incredibly rich meanings and never cease to surprise. You can RSVP for the event or learn more about Le Col at www.lecolvancleefarpels.com/US. That's www.lecolvancleefarpels.com/US. And now, here's Spencer and Bethann.
Joining me in the studio today is former model, advocate, and fashion industry groundbreaker, Bethann Hardison. She is also Gucci's executive advisor for global equity and cultural engagement. InStyle magazine has called her the fashion industry's conscience. Mm. Welcome, Bethann.
Oh, wow. That's a nice intro. Thank you.
I'd like to begin by bringing up a brand that's near and dear to your heart, Gucci. And I was wondering, how do you personally think about the evolution of Gucci as a company across time, or at least over the past few decades? And how do you think about your own very personal evolution with Gucci now being in this role you're in? When did Gucci first come onto your radar?
The late 70s? Yeah, I became a Gucci observer, I would say, because I was being sought after by Michael Cody, who was under John Fairchild at Women's Wear Daily, Fairchild Publications, and he wanted me to come work there. It is always interesting learning how my life is now that I'm writing about it, how many people really believed in me to do things that I wasn't ready to do or couldn't understand why they believed in me. But he would really try to get me any kind of way to talk me into coming to work for him and tell me that I could be the writer. I thought I couldn't write. And twice he asked me to come to lunch with him with Aldo Gucci. And so I'd go to... And Michael would have me, come on, we're going to go to lunch. We got to go see Aldo. And I'd sit there with them, and between me sit there, this little girl from Brooklyn, black girl, by the way, from Brooklyn, sitting there listening to these two guys talk, nothing to do with me. His point was to impress me. And I saw Aldo Gucci another time. Then I got kind of interested in Gucci because I liked that Gucci held true to culture, that they were in America, in New York City, on Fifth Avenue, and they closed their store from the siesta times that we do like in Latin countries. And I thought that was so cool that they were the only ones that would close the store so the employees could have a break. You know, you never forget things like that. And then I just liked all the terrible things used to hear that people thought was terrible, but I always liked gangsters as a kid. You know, I was into Legs Diamond and, you know, anybody, you know, Capone and all that stuff always intrigued me. So when you hear all these crazy stories about Gucci and dead bodies on the boat and cocaine and all, I was just intrigued. I thought this is my kind of, well, had nothing to do with buying apparel or buying of anything else, but it was just the idea of them, yeah. Mm. And then those times went by and it no longer was that anymore. And it became, you know, something that was conscious of apparel, which was never my cup of tea per se. You know, I was more style kind of girl, not so much luxury brand person, much more, you know, Japanese, you know, like Isamayaki, Kenzai Yamamoto, people like that. That was my inspiration more so. But then as time went on, then they did more apparel stuff. And then all of a sudden you notice that they have someone like Tom Ford and, you know, it never attracted me either. And then the next female designer never attracted me. When Alessandro came along, it was at a time that I was trying to change and educate the industry internationally about diversity. So it was a little scary because when he came along, he was a brand new guy that everyone was saying, yay, and his first show was all white kids. And I was just at that place where I was waking people's minds up. So it became something that really worried me. I said, oh, God, this guy, now he's brand new. I got to go back down the road and tell people, listen, I don't care what he's doing. Stay the path. But within the very next season, he had girls in his resort show that looked like me. And I thought, and it wasn't even like a show. It was actually a lookbook. And I thought one of the girls was me. How could he put me? And I'm saying again, I'm much older. And Edward Innerfield contacted me. He said, oh, my God, did you see that Gucci? My God, those girls look just like you. I said, I know. And then I'd open up my head. That was, I think, 3 or 4 years before they actually approached me.
And tell me a little about this role you're in now. What are you doing exactly with them?
It's interesting. You know, I giggle, because I don't know if I'm in the role because of who I am. But they respect me so much and appreciate me so much. And when you realize that the company is a small company with very few people who run it, it's small. But the real estate is so huge that you think, oh, my God, Gucci is huge. But when you get to see the guys and girls and women who run it, it's small. So I know them all. And it's very interesting for them how I play a part. I say what I think. And they expect that of me. Marco Bizzarri is someone who's so impressive. He's the CEO of Gucci. The relationship that he and Alessandro Michele has is very interesting. The fact that he could find this guy. The ones that he's added, the ones that he's kept, the ones that he added to the company are very unique in itself. It was nothing to teach them anything about diversity. It's nothing. You know, Italians may they be, and I had my life with Valentino, so I've lived a life of being around Italians. But it's very interesting to educate them, but these people really basically their hearts and minds are already there. So I like the fact that he listens to me, that it shouldn't be one person who comes in to be a DEI person. It's more important that the company is all DEI people. And that's what they bought, because they tried that when they got bombarded by the idea that the Bacala sweater was a blackface, you know. And for me, I looked at it, I still couldn't see blackface. So I understand that once the internet says something is something, God darn it, it's something. And so here we are, and you live with that kind of moment. But you found out that these people basically felt the pressure to go and find this person, because everybody says, well, if somebody was black there, that wouldn't have happened. Well, that's not true. I, after the fact, black then, I didn't even see it as that. So they go and you get somebody that's like that. But in the end of the day, that person doesn't necessarily serve the purpose of the company. The most important thing is the company to be serving themselves. That's what I was able to bring to that. And I was happy that I could share that wisdom, and that Mr. Bizzari listened to that too, that he agreed that we don't need someone from the outside coming in that's not even fashion to tell us how to be one person. We have to all be that person, and they all are. You know, they're concerned about so many more things that most big brands not even thinking about.
So you're basically like a cultural ambassador and a public editor.
Well, yeah, it's very true. And I'm a grandmama, you know. At this point, I'm accepting the role of that, because they really like, no, we don't want you to do too much. We don't, you know, I'm like, put me in, coach, put me in, you know. But anyway,
matriarch of Gucci, not a bad place to be.
No, true.
Early on in the pandemic, on May 18th, 2020, if I'm being exact, you made this great post on Instagram about the subject of time. And it was particularly about your time spent alive on Earth. And I wanted to quote a bit of it here. You wrote, if you are full on time, quote, fully grown, how you see things now opposed to how you might have seen them as a teenager or young adult differs. Experience, time, and wisdom seem to be the defining factors. In the same post, which was like right now during the month of Ramadan, you also made the point that I want to recognize my time on Earth and where I am today. So I thought it'd be an apt moment early on in the interview to do exactly that. Where are you today, right now, this minute, this second, other than the obvious, which is sitting here in this room with me?
Oh, that's a good one. Because I just thought of saying I need a friend. I'm going to put an ad in the newspaper. You know how they used to have ads in newspapers? Isn't that's a thing? Do we have ads in newspapers anymore? Like local ads from one person seek another person. I got a little frustrated with a friend of mine because they just wouldn't listen to me speak. And she means a lot to me. She's family. So at this stage of my life, I realize I am that to everyone, but I don't have anyone like that for me. And now I'm at a place where I would love to be able to have a friend. I was saying this to a couple other people as I've come to this conclusion, how important it is to have someone to talk to. And I had that with Toni Morrison. And it was when I was younger and life got in the way and, you know, I separated from Tori and, you know, you just keep moving along. But I recognized those moments we had. Who do you have that's someone that's your age or older that really is just wise and compassionate and kind? You don't find that. You know, I realize now I've been stuck with a lot of fashion people and I always thought they were cool. What do I know? And I've always been the mamacita to them all, even though I'm a young spirited person. But when you get to a place where you really recognize your time on Earth, I'm feeling right now that it is a place that I'm thinking about my democracy, the country I live in. Would I choose to live elsewhere? Would I go to Mexico, really? Would I spend more time in Marrakesh? I just stay upstate New York, but I love my city. I'm born and raised in New York, and I don't care what happens, but I need to have that energy, that slice. But I'm thinking about those things right now very prominently in my mind. That's where I'm at right now. Thinking of having a good friend, where am I going to live, and staying healthy.
The image for this post was a pink block with text that reads, I think the proper name for, quote, senior women should be queenagers.
Oh, yeah.
This concept of queenagers definitely made me laugh because I love a good pun. So.
Yeah, queenager. Yeah, that's funny. Yeah, that was funny.
As you age and as time goes on, how do you maintain this sort of youthful edge? You know, what do you think keeps that spirit, that energy alive? And I'm thinking here, too, this is something you share with our mutual friend, Kim Hestrider.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting when you talk about age and time, you know, because so many people think of themselves as old when they start to ache or when they recognize the time they're no longer 23 or 33. And I have infatuations with many younger people. A lot of young people. I have an infatuation with Harry Styles. I'm big on BTS boys now. You know, I no, but I am. Don't laugh. I have a crush on Aurora James. There's a good little daughter of mine that I really appreciate her spirit. You know, she gets on my nerves, of course, because she's younger than I and I'm a different generation. But that's intergenerational mentality. I think also the fact that I'm just lucky enough to be healthy. I don't have to have anything to keep my organs going. And I'm constantly thinking about what to do next. Also, there's always something falling at my feet to do. I'm trying to think now, is it possible I could get real estate for the young designers that I'm working with somewhere in L.A. or maybe here in New York where I can have a place where they can put their goods? And I know this guy in Limerick Park, and I'm thinking about that. You know, I'm watching how my mind works. It's not that I want to not retire. It's just a way that I'm just here to do things. And I think there are people who come to Earth that meant to do. That's just destiny. And I think I'm not trying to do, I don't think of myself as older. Even when I look at images of myself now, I go, wow, look at that. That ain't, Oh, people say, oh, but Beth Ann, you look so much a lot. You look just the same. And I keep saying, what, are they kidding me? I'm not. But yeah, I'm recognizing it. I'm recognizing it. I know. And when I ache, I don't think of myself as old. I think I just ache because I know a lot of young people who ache. I don't let my mind go in that direction. It's not because I'm trying not to. It just doesn't. And I do believe in, you know, if they say that cannabis helps you, do it. If a shot of tequila works, laying in a hammock, whatever it takes to just have time with yourself. I think that's the most important thing for me. And I'm selfish enough. And it's a good selfish. I'm conscious of my selfishness.
Yes.
And that's why I need
self-carishness.
Yes, exactly. That's why I say, I need a friend. I'm going to put an ad in some paper. Yeah. Billish Voice, maybe. No one reads it, but who cares?
It's back.
It's back. I got a copy the other day in that luxury store called Zabar. Yeah. Have you ever been in there?
Yeah.
Oh, my God. Okay. Go ahead.
Last year in Vogue, you said age is something I just don't give into. I think more about running out of time.
Oh, yeah. Well, you're good. That's good. Yeah.
You said it.
Yeah, no, it's true. No, and this is very true. Yeah, because that's the thing. You have things you want to do. And you, yeah, I don't think about, oh, my God. And I definitely don't fear dying. That, I think, that's why I'm never mad at anyone who takes their life. I say, oh, I get that. And people say, oh, it's so sad. Well, I don't know. I mean, some people are not meant to be here the whole time. I mean, life is not all it's cracked up to be, as they say. If you're not having a good time with it and it's not working for you, I mean, I understand. But I really do believe that that's what you worry about. You worry about, did you get everything done that you wanted to do? Did you put all your ducks in a row? It's muy importante, no? I think it's very important to sort of like consciously know that you're living to die.
How you spend it.
It's how you spend it, really. And if you don't do anything with it, it's fine. You know, like everybody's not supposed to go to college. Everybody's not supposed, you know what I mean? If people can drop out. If a kid wanted to drop out of school in junior high school and go farm, wouldn't that be cool? Yeah, it would be, depending on what place you're farming in.
So you're working on a memoir. Tell me about this. When did you start thinking about a book being something you should do?
Back in the 80s, I was approached to write a book. Marie Brown, I'll always have to give a shout out to her because she stayed on me. She's a book editor. When I first started my agency, Beth Ann Management, in 1984, I think somewhere around that time she came to me. She saw then because there was no one like me. I was the only black representing white kids. You know, I had an agency. It had black kids in it, Latin kids in it, Asian kids in it, but it was primarily a white agency. That to her was unique in itself, in that I could actually have that vision. And she was asking me to, and I was thinking I could do it. Never could get it together, you know. I mean, she was so patient. That was back then. And, you know you're supposed to do it, then you feel you owe it to your community. And so I kept on thinking about it, but never being able to do it because never having time. Then when I met Tony, but years later, not after the good years of Tony and I talking all the time, but
Toni Morrison.
Toni Morrison, thank you so much. That was another time that she was the one who came upon me to say, and I didn't know when we used to hang out that she was really that book editor before. Writer, yes. But then one day she was saying to me, she said, let me tell you something. If I was still in that business and I was still an editor, and I looked at her and I didn't know that. And she said, you would have a book out by now. And I said, really? She said, Beth Ann, your story needs to be told. And she said that a couple of times to me in my adult life. When I said adult life, it's like more in the years of the last 10, 15 years, 20 years.
Coming from pretty much the preeminent storyteller of the 21st century.
Yeah.
And the 20th century.
Yeah. And it puts you to want to, you know, I'm just writing my little stories because I'm thinking in my mind the way my astrologer said to me one time when I just couldn't figure out how to get going, once I realized I really need to write it. And then I found that a literary agent who really felt that I should do it when I was going to do it. And then I gave up on it. And she wanted to meet me and we talked and she said, whatever way you want to write it, just do whatever you want to do. And she gave me that space to do. And I thought about Tony speaking to me too. I was thinking, how am I going to approach it? My life is so full. I just have lots of stories and things. I'm not trying to do anything. And my astrologer once said to me, the way you should write your story is by telling about all the people you've met along the way. That's your story. And that didn't click. And that was the way to start to tell this and write. So now I just write about instances of my meetings, my things, my moments with these different people. And that helps to tell, because that's what everybody says when they read my posts. They say things in Instagram. Oh my God, I can't wait for your book. I can't, you know. So that becomes the audience, the crowd, you know, and then you feel the obligation to give the story back. And not that's the reason why you cannot, you know, like in your life now. This is the reason why you cannot. It's because you have to tell the stories. You owe it to a community. And the community is broad, integrated, definitely diverse, young and old. And I always wanted to be able to do something with the generation that's before the generation that's supposed to be the generation now. So that's got to be now. I should be talking to 11 and 12-year-olds and not the 20-year-olds. Now I should be talking to maybe the 9 and 8-year-olds now.
I was wondering if you could just speak to this idea of wisdom quickly, because I feel like this project at this moment in your life, having lived the incredible life you've lived, how do you think about this project in the context of wisdom?
Yeah, that's an interesting, you know, everyone doesn't have that. Wisdom is like, I don't know how to explain what wisdom is. I tried to say that to a young person one time, but it's not a luxury, but it's something almost like that. It's very, they're few and far in between. You don't meet many people with wisdom. You meet a lot of people with opinions, you know, but wisdom is something very special. And I think that I know that I have wisdom. I know that only because my father used to tell me I was wise. I didn't understand that when he used to say it to me. But as time going on, he said to me, look at all your friends. You know, I used to be in a gang when I was a kid, right? And he was nice enough when I went to live with him to let me ease myself out of this gang, so to speak. But he used to say to me, look at that. He said, look, let's start another kind of gang for you. Why don't you start with all your girlfriends? And it was called the Quareish. And it's interesting because he let me see that I had such influence over many people. And that was when I was 13, 14, 15. Many people would come to me. Many of my friends would listen to if something was an argument, a debate. He said, and that's why I was on a debating team. Look how you can argue. Look how you see things, how you bring, you can understand both sides and how you right in the middle of it. And then he would show me that me being even, you know, with astrology, he would share with me my sign, the balance of Libra. And so I think it's an interesting thing about wisdom that it's really, I think it's birthed out of compassion. Hmm. And sometimes you have it a way of just being, seeing both sides of a coin and being able to kindly educate with that and not judge so much. I get frustrated. As you get older, you do get frustrated with more, and you want to lessen the audience, lessen the amount of people. And you have to, there are certain people you don't want to let go of. I will always have crushes on boys. That's one thing. I mean, not like 12-year-olds, but I mean, you know, when they get to be like in their 20s, yeah, you know, like for sure. You can just crush. Crushes are wonderful things. They're not like anything other than admiration, basically, you know. It makes you feel good because they're inspiring, you know. And I think those are the kind of things that you find, too, that you have that kind of wisdom. Even in my book, people say, my publisher says, your book is going to be special because you're going to release a lot of things for women. A lot of things that most people would never say, you say. A lot of things you think, you're going to make people feel better about how they can think that too, or feel better about themselves. And that might be coming from a basic sense of wisdom, if that might be the answer to that question. But I think that when she said that to me, I thought it was interesting, because I do. I mean, come on. At night, late at night, my secret to you, and I'll share, is that I look at reels of BTS, okay? Only just to practice dance steps. Now, come on. I'm a dancer, and I'm impressed with the boys because they can dance. Like, I mean, really can dance. So what you see normally in a performance, you're not going to see what I see. I see a lot of the rehearsals, and it's impressive to me that I can sit and spend that kind of time to even express that kind of thing. Because most people, when you're a certain age, you just don't do things like that. You know, who does? I do.
You're also working on this documentary film about your life called Invisible Beauty. Tell me about this project, and what is it like seeing your life quite literally through this lens?
Yeah, that's it's very interesting to me too. That was something that I had started, and Invisible Beauty was because I was trying to use this medium to reflect what was going on in the fashion industry at the time. And it was really about, I was trying to tell the story of how at some given point, the fashion industry had gotten lost when it came down to its basic inclusion mentality, racial inclusion. And it was going to be about three girls, and it was going to, you know, show their stories and how the industry had lost their way. Because I was part of the times when it was good times. I was Versailles, you know? So, of course, I know and worked with Stephen Burrows. I can name so many designers that were of color at the time. So it was, for me, that's what it was going to be. And then, you know, people would say, you should be in it. And I go, no, definitely not in it. I'm just behind the scenes, and I'm just going to make sure I tell the story. And eventually, it became my story. Because even though I thought, well, I don't need to do this anymore because I've helped to change the mentality of the international industry of fashion. They've now been finding themselves being inclusive of the girl and boy of color. And someone said, are you kidding? You need to do it. Somebody needs to do a documentary on you. And I remember telling my first director, yeah, all right, the story's on me. And he said, thank God, because I was always so resistant.
Well, it's entangled, right? I mean, there's the industry through you and you through the industry.
Yeah.
It's both.
Yeah. So if you had been with me at the time, I would have recognized that long time ago. but I was so busy fighting it, you know. And so now, yes, it's my story. And how I feel about it, you just hope that, God, I hope it's enough. Like, I didn't think I had even enough archives. And then they say, oh, my God, she has so much archives. I go, I do? I was never a print girl. I wasn't famous. I was popular. And it's a great difference. I wasn't like a celebrity. I'm still not. People say, oh, my God, are you kidding? No, I'm known. But that's a difference. It's not the same. And so for me, I didn't imagine it was enough information that anybody would care enough. But then people start to say that, you know, are you kidding? You are a story. And then when Frederick Chang, my director, I would lean on him after I had met him and he had done my 3-minute piece for my CFDA award. I would lean on him after I got to know him and talk to him about what I was trying to do. And he compared my story to what he had worked on, which was Mrs. Vreeland, Diana Vreeland's The Eye Has to Travel. And I loved that film so much. I thought, well, maybe there is something to me. I don't know, because I just don't think there's something. But as you know, we got people who wanted to give us grants. The Ford Foundation first stepped up a long time ago when I was just talking about the industry. I think it came down to a fact that he he was onto something and everybody else was right. And there is something there. And I just see that when people give money to you and you can get equity and they see what we've presented at the Sundance Catalyst program, then you start thinking, well, maybe there's something to it. And I hope that we, I keep saying, I know the book will come out. I don't know if the film will. And people say, you're kidding me, right? But you just don't know if it's enough of an audience. Maybe it's not me being, I'm just hoping and praying that, you know, there's enough story there that will be worth its weight in gold.
Obviously, both these projects are about legacy. They're also about memory. And they're also about lessons learned. They're coming out of or through or kind of during this pandemic and amidst tremendous grief and loss. And I wanted to ask you about that. How have you been thinking about these past 2 years, and particularly those who have left us, regardless of the reasons for them leaving us, COVID or not? And I'm thinking of Virgil Abloh, Sidney Poitier, bell hooks, Greg Tate, Grace Mirabella. There's a lot of loss, and you knew all these people individually.
Yeah. Also, between the Islamic part and the Christian part, my grandmother always said, we come here to die, and my father, who lived their life, to go to paradise. Death is something that I'm sort of one of those people who I champion it in a way, because I know it's inevitable. So whoever goes, whatever way they go, shucks, like that. You bite the, it's like biting a bullet when you hear about it. But that's the deal, right? So during the pandemic, the only thing that was hard for me, the only thing that has been hard for me for results, because I see here so many people were depressed by it, was the loss of so many people dying. And I lost someone that I was close to, because I started thinking about her, because she lived in Brooklyn. She was older, maybe my age or younger, but very fit. And I thought, oh my God, Vera. And that was like March 20. And by the time I rang her house, she lived alone. Only young woman answered, it was her daughter. She had just died the week before. And I was like, John. And so that kind of thing, and you're trying to fight and hope you don't die, but I'm upstate New York, and you're watching it change up there slowly too. It hit the city rampantly. So during the pandemic for me, it was, during this pandemic now, I feel like, well, it's a lot of loss, and people are going to pass away. But so many people are passing away now, young and old. I mean, so many around you. I don't think the young people in my generation of time growing up, we didn't know that many people that passed away. We don't know that many deaths like young people. We don't know that. That's for old people. Death is old people. But now it's like many people. Young people take their lives like you can't believe. They get bullied into things. There's so much of it. The pandemic to me is just a sideshow. I hate to say it, but that's the way I look at it.
Yeah, you look at the painkiller situation in this country.
Tell me about it. Now that they've reopened up the sporting, I say that now that people can now bet like they can now on their phones and all that, where do you see what that's going to bring? That's going to bring a lot of hardship. A lot of people are not going to want to be here because they lost all their money or they started stealing. It becomes addictive. So there's a lot of ways to leave this earth, a lot of things that can take you out of here. Unfortunately, we have lost a lot of people. I lost a lot of people during HIV AIDS, that pandemic. That was major. You know, to see almost an industry, so many brilliant people just being wiped out, guys you know. So it's kind of a, you know, we've been through a pandemic before. This generation has been, and now there's a generation that's going through it. And for all the parents out there, let me say to you, I really mean it. Stop making your kids think that it's a terrible what they're having to have to go through. You should make them pull up their bootstrings and understand this is their time. This is what they're living through. And stop acting like what a terrible thing, because that elitist mentality is no bueno.
Once we're through this one, there's going to be another.
It's always something. Make your kids know, come on, because this is not the Roman times. This is not the slavery time. This is their time. And it's not so as bad as you think other people have had it.
About a year ago, you wrote this really beautiful post on Instagram about Carol LaBrie. Another life lost. And I was hoping you could talk about her here. I imagine most listeners don't know who she is.
Oh, Oh, that's so nice you bring up Carol. Carol LaBrie was one of those models. Yeah, Carol LaBrie. That was back in the day. That was late 60s, early 70s. Carol LaBrie was a wonderful model. And she was an American girl, beautiful. When Essence came along, you know, we talk about diversity and things like that. We're out of the Black Panther moment, you know, black is beautiful. We came out of all of that. And Carol LaBrie, I remember, said there's an image of her and the girls marching with their hands struck up like this. It was a photo shoot, and it was for Essence magazine, a feature in Essence. But Carol worked with Kenzo. She was very close to Kenzo in Paris. And that was my most memorable moment of her. And she was his muse. Kenzo's store was on Place de Victoire in Paris. But back in those days in Paris, there were such unique models like Marion Wambo for YSL, Carol LaBrie for Kenzo. There were certain kids, and they were brown kids, you know. But she was beautiful, and she had a lot of attitude. She was tall, and she and she was so beautiful. And she was married to Uli Rose, which was a photographer, fashion photographer, that, you know, these two met, and God knows she was like fire and he's like calm water. I never knew, understand how those two could be together. He was Scandinavian and she's like a mixed fiery girl of color. And so they stayed together and they had these wonderful kids. And I thought when she passed away, that photograph itself was so beautiful of her that it just, she just needed recognition. I think it's more important to recognize people right when they've passed away, pretty much within the ether of their spiritual movement.
Something floating.
Yeah, you know, really at that time, than to do things when it's 2 and 3 months later and you say, oh, here's a memorial and here, and then I think, who's doing them? What is this for? You know, you get a little disappointed about things like that. But yeah, I'm thank you for bringing Carol up because she was truly a representation of what fashion was like then and what the spirit of Paris was like back then. And it was just, it was beautiful times.
Let's get into your upbringing in Brooklyn. Tell me about your parents, your grandparents. Tell me about the tap dancing, the cheerleading.
Well, I grew up in Bedford-Stuyvesant until I was 12 years old. And I went to live with my father, who lived in Crown Heights on Park Place when I was 12. I did join a gang when I was 9. My grandmother and my mother worked. I was a latchkey kid, so from 7 years old. When I started going to school, I had to go to school and come home to an empty house. So I had to have the key. Latchkey kids are kids who have the key around their neck, more likely on a string or something or ribbon. And we let ourselves in and we take care of ourselves. That's what's called a latchkey kid. And, you know, latchkey kid, well, my mother was very organized and we lived in rooming houses, the three of us. And she would leave my clothes out on the bed and everything. I was always impressed with this girl because, girl being my mother, because she was a girl. And how organized she was, you know, and neat and clean. So I would take myself out, change my clothes from my school clothes and then put on my play clothes and go out. Eventually, I became part of this gang. It's called the Chaplains. And I remember at a very wonderful interview at Schoenberg Museum, I gave a shout out to my gang and that impressed the audience. But when things are important in your life, they get a shout out. So I was part of the Lady Chaplains until that time, from 9 until I went to live with my dad. These gangs back at the time, they were lightweight. I mean, you got beat up if you went in the wrong neighborhood and maybe someone got stabbed. That's as much as gangs did back in the day. But that was a 5-borough gang. So it was one of the biggest, the Chaplains. And there are a lot of other gangs, too, but that's not, we don't mention them because we give a name credit to only the Chaplains. I ran track at the age of, I think I started running track at 11. I ran the 100 relay until about, yeah, I think about until I was about 12. But somewhere in between there, I started tap dancing. I was very busy as a child. My grandmother, my mother, they didn't know what I was doing next. They was just trying to keep up with me. And I was just, I was the kind of kid who would come home and say, okay, this is what I'm doing. Or I learned I'm going to go do this. And they go, uh-huh, okay. It's the opposite of what people do today. Parents who really basically have to be busy putting their kids in certain places. and you know,
the it's like free, prescribing them.
Yeah, and helicoptering them and protecting them and building their self-esteem and all that stuff that, you know, parents have to work hard at now. It's so different when you grow up and can walk out your door and hang out and your parents say, okay, be home by 7 or don't be late for dinner or, you know, give you the freedom to be outside. We grew up in a different way. And so to grow up in New York City in that manner was everything. I grew up in Brooklyn. And, you know, for me, I never knew when a teacher would say that we were lower upper income. And I go, well, that don't sound like we're poor, but it doesn't sound like you're like medium income either. But when you look around your neighborhood and you see nothing but tree-lined streets, you never think you're living in the ghetto, but still they would allude to the fact that you were in the ghetto. That was only mostly because everybody in their neighborhood was of the same color. But we were never in the ghetto. Parents worked, people had nice homes. Some people had nicer homes. We lived in a rooming house owned by one person, but there were people who I went to visit, their parents owned all the houses, mostly because they were from the Caribbean too. That's another thing that's different. I liked growing up as a kid. I had no bad issues. I mean, I'm very lucky that way. And when I went to live with my dad, that was a whole new ball game.
He was an imam.
He was an imam. He was an Islamic leader, but a very cool guy, good looking. He was the brown Yul Brynner. Everybody, when Yul Brynner came along, they kept saying, man, that guy looks like you. You know, they always say to my father. And he was good. He was a very inspirational person to a lot of the musicians who were coming around embracing Islam at that time. When
Elijah Muhammad.
Thank you. Elijah Muhammad wanted to come into New York. He was in Chicago. My father sat and told my stepmother and I that he was going to Chicago to meet with him. They wanted to discuss coming into New York. My father was Orthodox Muslim, so it was different. And he was also an imam. He was a Hajj. He had gone to Mecca 3 times. So the idea that he had influence with Malcolm X when Malcolm was having his problems or wanting to go into Mecca or when he started having his problems with Elijah, he would come and seek my father's counsel. And then I went to high school. My high school years were phenomenal to me. I had gotten into performing arts, but I chose to go to the school because this white guy came to my junior high school and he was so cool and he showed these pictures of the school that was so architecturally designed. It was a banjo. And I just said, okay, that's where I'm going. So my mother said, well, what happened to that other school you worked so hard to get into? Nah, I'm going to this school. And I stayed and it was like destiny because I became very successful in the school. The school bodies that sophomore, junior, and senior voted me to be in a sing, which we do a performance to compete against each other's grades each year. And it was wonderful to learn about myself, the bit of leadership, or like my dad used to say about that sense of wisdom, how people draw to you because of how you live with people, how you deal with people, how you see things. And it was just very good for me to see that. And now that I'm writing, I recognize and appreciate it more.
And you mentioned in previous interviews that you didn't realize it at the time, but you were actually part of a busing program.
Yeah, I didn't know that. There was an Italian girl who used to go to school with me, and we were both grown. And one day she contacted me because she had found my number or something. And she said, hey, you know what I want to tell you? You didn't realize that when you came to Wingate that you were part of a busing program? What do you mean? She said, you were part of the busing. I never knew that. Yeah, that's why that white guy, and you know, you grow up in an all black neighborhood. You know, at some point you want to step out. That was just what it was for me. He was so cool, the way he was dressed, his little shirt. And his. I always remember that whole moment in assembly. And I told my best girlfriend, I said, we're going, because she would follow anything I do. She was such a good friend. And we went and it was just part of that. It was a great experience.
And from there you sort of fail through NYU art school. You attend FIT for a couple years, but don't graduate. You become a young mother.
Yeah.
And then you go work as a corrections officer at a New York State prison.
I'm so sorry you know about that because I keep saying to people, where did you find this? I said, it's on your website. I said, what? So I told the guy who wrote it, I never read the website. I never read the bio. Oh, God, I don't want anybody to know about that. Jesus. Because, you know, how that came out was that, Clovis Ruffin told Bernadine Morris of the New York Times that one time because I was his fit model. I was so upset.
It'll be in your memoir, though.
Yeah, I think so. I basically was just really coming out of wanting to always believe that I wanted to be in the help in the law area of life. I wanted to help people. And I saw this movie, Snake Pit, one time, and it was all about this crazy prison for women. I don't know how. And I was dating a guy at the time, and his mother was a correction officer. And I thought that's the way I get into at least helping people. And I was the first officer that was hired. I passed the test, but I was the youngest. And so they had to let me wait 1 year before they could appoint me because I had to be 21. So I applied it in 19. You could apply in 20. You could apply at any time, but you couldn't be appointed until you're 21. So that's what happened.
And you've spoken a lot about your time in the garment district, your job at a button factory, as a showroom salesperson, an office manager, a fit model. And out of this period, through this, you meet Willie Smith. This is a pivotal, life-changing moment for you.
Yeah.
I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about Willie, and particularly in light of this Cooper Hewitt exhibition curated by Alexandra Cunningham Cameron that you helped make happen.
As you were saying, I was just whispering to myself, I love Willie. Everyone loved Willie. Willie used to see me in the street of the garment district, and he sent this young girl. They used to be like have runners for the Federated stores when they'd go around to different offices to get the orders and pick it up. So he asked if she knew who I was, and she said she thought she did, and he wrote a note and said, please contact this woman and tell her that I want to meet with her, and da, da, da. Well, at that time, I was a girl. And I took a chance because it was Willie Smith, and my office at the time was very supportive. Two Jewish women, Ruth Manchester and Sylvia Courtney, who just wanted me to be so successful. And I met Willie in that way. And he asked me what I considered being his model for a few things because he thought I was a designer. And I said, no, I work in a showroom. He said, wow, man, you're so cool, blah, blah, blah. Would you consider? And I said, yes. And I went back and talked to my two women employers. And they said, oh, yes, you have to do that. And so I started working with Willie. And I really basically am so proud of what we have done in this time frame, keeping Willie's name alive, mostly because we have so many people who are creatives now, who are entrepreneurs, who are working in the industry of fashion and design, apparel design, that they should know who he was. Mostly for those who think that, you know, oh, it's so difficult being a black designer. I keep saying you're not a black designer, you're a designer of color, that you basically, to keep their minds going forward, to know that there were people before you, way before you, that did very well. And so I'm very proud that Alexandra, who knew nothing about Willie, heard about him. She being the visionaire and curator that she is, that said, let's get a museum show for him. I got one set up for Stephen Burroughs, who was my other bookend. And here we go. And this is another man of the wonderful talent of color. And that's all. That's my job. That was my job. The two of them, and I'm so proud of that show, that she was able to erect that in that wonderful museum. And, you know, you don't need the Metropolitan Museum. You just need an exhibiting hall. City Museum of New York. And to me, that was so important that both these two young men had the opportunity to have an actual show that many people saw, because they deserve it so much. And there'll be a lot of designers, white, black, Asian, will always be very great designers, but they won't be able to have a museum show. That's like it, you know, when you've gone. So it's really wonderful. I'm very proud of him.
And the breadth of what Willie did in his short life.
Yeah.
Working with Christo, creating these incredible retail with James Wines.
Yes. Just being simply Willie, just being that kind, simple guy that when people would meet him, they liked him. And they could see the basics of his aesthetic was always great. But it went beyond apparel. That's what you're saying. And that was true, you know, working with Bill T. Jones or working with creatives as choreographers. The people who would meet him, he did furniture for Knoll. I mean, he did things. simplicity and butterick patterns, you know, things that no designers get opportunities like this as before. These are collaborations that you think about, wow. And that Christos and Jean-Claude, thank you. So glad you're here. that they would recognize in him and bring him to Paris, wherever they would be. Even to do Edward Schlossenberg's suit for to marry little Miss Kennedy. Just things like that. It's genius.
Hey everyone, taking a quick break here to tell you a little bit about our season 5 sponsor, L'Ecole School of Jewelry Arts, which is supported by the Maison Van Cleef and Arpels. In addition to exhibitions, publications, research projects, and public events, L'Ecole offers a range of courses led by experts across jewelry, craft, history, and the arts. Celebrating its first decade this year, L'Ecole, which has permanent campuses in both Paris and Hong Kong, is opening a third space in Shanghai and another in Paris, which will feature a public library of roughly 6,500 reference works on jewelry and gems. At its main Paris space, L'Ecole is also opening a Gemotech, or gem library, that contains some 1,200 stones for visitors to view and even handle. This year, they'll also be presenting 6 exhibitions in Hong Kong, Tokyo, and Paris, and publishing 8 books. You can learn more about L'Ecole and its current and upcoming offerings at www.lecolevancleefarpels.com. That's www.lecolevancleefarpels.com. And now, back to the episode. So from here, you go on to become this successful model alongside Beverly Johnson, Alva Chin, Pat Cleveland, and your best friend, Iman. Mm-hmm. In 1973, there was, of course, the incredible Battle of Versailles that you mentioned earlier, which pitted these American designers against French houses.
Yeah.
And a year later, you graced the cover of Essence magazine. Tell me about this transition from the garment district to a runway model in just a matter of years.
Oh, yeah. That was, yeah. That, because I had, once again, the support of, you know, that's what great thing about growing up in the garment business, because I had people who really believed in me. It's hard for me when people start think that everything, you know, it's so hard to get up because you're Black. It's so hard to get up because you're a woman. It's so hard to get up. And I had just the opposite. I was a young Black girl who found the job through the New York Times ads advertising and was hired. And when I even got fired within my own company, the manager of the company would find me and put me in another department. She kept educating me. These were Jewish people, white people. So when people have these hard times, and maybe it's because times have changed, but Lord knows it's not because people are not good. When they have good in front of them, they want to improve that good. They saw good in me. And how I first started to model was because there was a man named Bernie Ozer who actually worked at the Federated Stores, and he was head of junior dresses. And he used to put on very big shows because he liked Broadway to impress his buyers from different stores. And I wind up getting this job to be in his show. And because I was former tap dancer and I was taking samples over, and I said, well, you know, I watch all these people giving these things. He's talking about this show and show and show. By the time I reached him without samples from Ruth Manchester, I leaned over and said, if you really want to have a great show, you'll put me in it. And you know, that was interesting because I always say I'm not ambitious, because I always felt like I've never been ambitious. But these moves that I made were just opportunities I saw, and I had enough courage to say things, but I never think I want to do this. I'm just...
No, it's a seize the moment.
That's right. And I'm just trying to, you know, help the other guy out. So I wind up doing that first as a show, and I performed so well in the show that I became this model. And then eventually, you know, with Willie and other people, it happened. Eventually left having a job. Because being a young person, you sometimes mess up and people eventually have to fire you because you just are heartbroken over a boyfriend or you can't get to work. Or, you know, just, you know, when you're young, you can really mess up. And I wind up working with Willie as an assistant and stuff, and him trying to keep me afloat. And then he introduced me to Stephen Burrows. And eventually I got to be eventually, it took a while for Stephen to bring me on, and I worked with Stephen. And then all of a sudden, when Eleanor Lambert decided that, you know, she and Francois de la Renta were going to do Versailles and try to bring American designers to Paris to sort of like build, give a benefit for the Marie Antoinette Theater at Versailles, to use the excuse that Eleanor Lambert saw the opportunity to bring America into the international stage, having five designers, which were all her clients. And basically, the deal was each designer gets three models, or the deal was if for a model to go, they had to be chosen by three of the designers. It took a while for me to get selected. I had two, and I was looking, and I had to go because I was Stephen Burroughs' assistant. Not only was I his fit model and a model for others, I was also his assistant. He needed me to be there, and he already developed this dress for me. So for me to go from these points to point, it was just the road traveled. You know, it's just the way it is. It's not like something you're planning or you're scouting out. Ambition is one thing that I never really, I seriously mean it when I say it. It looks like it because I achieve things, but it's never because I'm plotting. Ambition is something that you really have the desire, and then get out there and get the job done. Me, I'm just along on the road. The car comes by. I get in the car. We go someplace. It's as simple as that.
There's this incredible event you organized in 1976 that I wanted to bring up, Issey Miyake and 12 Black Girls, a presentation you organized in Tokyo and Osaka. And I haven't really heard you talk about it, but it's just like an event for the history books. I mean, 12 Black models, what was it like for you? Like, how did...
Wait, you need to stop. How do you get all this stuff? Wow, you're blowing my mind. You're right about that. Thank you. Make a note. Can you make a note? I should write about that. What am I thinking? Okay, there's so much to write about. Okay, look, okay. All right, what was the question?
What was it like for you to organize that project and event? And how did the Japanese respond? How did the world of fashion respond?
Wow, yeah. I've always been considered Issey like brother, me like sister, you know? And I was a muse of Issey. And then I was also working for Stephen Burroughs as my full-time job, because I had a full-time job. I've never been a model like the other girls, you know? I just was able to model, but I always had to have a full-time job. I couldn't afford to be a model. Modeling for me was like just performing. It was like me going out and doing a tap dance show. For other girls, that was their thing. That's all they had. And I never thought I could afford to be. But when I was working with Stephen Burroughs, the good news is I went to talk to the owners of our company, and I asked them if I could also go to Paris from time to time, because I was being asked to come there by Sylvie Grumbach, and she knew a couple of designers that wanted to work with me in Paris. And they said, listen, as long as you do the work, you can go. You always seem to get it done. Because at that time, Paris came before New York. And so I was able to go over. I got to work with Issey in that time frame. And that's how I first met Issey Miyake. That was his first show in Paris. And we connected. I was a real samurai, you know. I can't remember my inspiration's name. Toshiro Mifune. Okay? He was my inspiration. He was a Japanese actor. He played in all the samurai movies. So when I worked with Issey could see that in me. I worked hard. We connected. Over the years, I worked with him. I was working still with Stephen Burroughs, and he needed to do a show in Japan, and he wanted to do the show, East Meets West. And I was not able to go. I don't know if I was not able to go, I didn't want to go, whatever the case may be. Maybe it was a conflict of our collection. But I still was the one who helped to organize the girls, who he should have, which models he should make sure. I always had to, Issey always had to have my energy if I wasn't even physically there. And so that was great, the first one. And then the second one, he said, I don't care what happens, you have to come. And the second one, I went as well. And so we had everyone from Grace to Iman to Tookie. Yeah, there was a lot of good girls then.
What was the result?
Once we got there, it was so hard. I'd never ever wanted to go back to Japan, because I always said Japan is where I lost my youth, because I never worked so hard. First of all, they work extremely hard. No one works harder than the Japanese, as far as I'm concerned, in my experiences. But you work hard with them. And then we would go down, I would go down that runway, and they never even clap. They just sit there and look at you. And you know, we're used to, and it's a huge stage, and we're used to so much response. And I would work so hard up on that stage, and I could just see my youth just floating away from me into the audience. I said, I don't even have the energy anymore to do this. It was really something that was really powerful. It was Tokyo, and we learned a lot too, experiencing, for me, especially being in a country where I had never gone to a country where it wasn't run by Caucasians. So for me to see a country that primarily when you saw a white person, you were shocked. You were like, oh man, a white person, like that. It was very impressive. That was my first experience. The goodness of the show in Tokyo was wonderful. And then to go to Osaka was wonderful. It was always a great tribute because Issei had become very successful in that country too, in his country. And look, we still have Issei Miyake. He's alive still. I'm still alive. He's more recluse. I'm not. The differences of us. Sometimes I think I'd go back just to see him. Yeah.
You launched your eponymous model and talent agency, Beth Ann Management, in 1984. And in 1988, you founded the Black Girls Coalition with Iman. Mm-hmm. These become wildly successful. You continue on this sort of path. You sign all these top models, including Tyson Beckford, who becomes the first Black man to get super status.
Yeah.
But then 1996 comes around and you decide to close, get out of the industry. What happened?
Oh, I never wanted to get in it. I hated doing that. Are you kidding? Oh, what a terrible. I was thinking, all right, one day I'm going to go off and I'm going to LA and I'm going to work in a music business or a film business. You know, I was trying to have some ambition. It doesn't work for me, ambition. And I had a young man tell me, the same young man who introduced me to Tony many years ago. And he said to me, why would you do that when you're already known in an industry that really is appreciating you? Why don't you stay in your own industry? What own industry? That's not my industry. Well, that's the industry that knows you. And he convinced me to stop looking over there. And when I was working at this agency, Click, and I was going to leave there to do my own agency, it was interesting for me at that time because I was going to work with another agency from Paris, and she sort of like duped me, and I was stuck. And I had already said goodbye to my agency that I was presently with, which was Click. And I was just only reminded by Bonnie Berman, who really found me the money, and these young kids really believed in me. They believed that I should do this. So I don't want to do it, but I got to do something. I'm used to working. I have to pay the rent. And so she found me the money, and these kids were willing to do exactly what had never been done before. Then I said, well, I can't do it because we don't have enough money. You need a lot of money. They said, well, how much do you need? And I said, well, what do you need it for? Well, you have to pay the models in advance because that's what Elite did. That's what Ford did. She said, we'll wait for the money. We'll wait with you for the money. If you don't get the money, we don't get paid. Wow, I couldn't get out. Then I would talk to someone like Stephen Meisel and Lisa Robinson. And I started talking about the name, and you know, everyone was just convincing me I had to do it. Then they said I had to use my own name, and I didn't want to do that. And then they were like, what are you, crazy? Such a good name. So I got stuck in it, really. And then I became successful in it. You know, I said to them when I took the money to do it, I was able to pay back the money like in 2 or 3 years, but could I get out in 3? They said, no, if you're going to take the money, we got to at least do 5. 5 turned to 7, 7 turned to 9, 9 turned to 11. By year 12, I said, I'm getting out of this. Because I could see the handwriting on the wall, maybe without clarity, that this was something I didn't need to stay in anymore. I don't have a lot of clarity about what I want to do in life, but you do know when the road is ending, and you just have to step away. I don't have a career. People say, oh my God, your career is so amazing. Oh, so what career? You mean my life? Oh, that's different. If you're talking, I don't have a career. Career is like doctor, singer, you know, I don't know. You know, things that people, that's all they do, and that's what they get paid for. Me, I'm like jack of all trades, master of none almost, you know? So I basically told my assistant at the time, I'm out 1 year from now. And she said, I'm with you. And that's what I did. I was getting rid of all the top models. But Ralph Lauren was like, as soon as I was telling them I'm going, they were getting ready. They were telling me, well, we want another 2 years with Tyson. 3 years. No, another year, they said, with an option for two more. That's what it was, because they started with two. I was like, oh, no, I got to get stuck in this stuff. I was trying to get out. I can't get out. They pull you right back in. And then I wind up taking Tyson and keeping Tyson and having the Ralph Lauren deal, keeping my office. I love my office. I never wanted to let that go. I didn't care. As long as I could find a way to pay the rent was low. But in the end of the day, it wind up being a thing that worked out in the end for me. But the reason to leave it was because it wasn't something I wanted to do all along. And once again, the good news is that it was changing anyway. Yeah, and I was meant to go forward. Yeah. And talking about the Black Girls Coalition, that was something that was interesting too, because I was just doing that because I wanted to have a party to celebrate the fact that so many girls of color were working back in the 80s, something that had never happened. We never had girls work editorially like this. This was a big thing. And a lot of people don't know it. We had black runway models all up and down the street. But to have a lot of girls working like in editorial, and I have to give credit always to Regis Penez, and I will give this man credit until I pass. Because without him coming from France to start Elle magazine for Filippanchi, the publishing company, we would never even have those girls like we have them now. He didn't care about color. He loved brown girls. And even when he put a blonde girl in, she always was in Africa, all skin brown, lots of black, little brown kids around her. That was Frenchelle. He came to New York and he put those girls on the cover and competed completely with Condé Nast and Harper's Bazaar till they had to start doing a similar thing because his magazine took off like that. And we were on covers and inside the magazine. So I was there celebrating. I couldn't take all the girls of color because I didn't want a black model agency. I needed to be integrated.
You're about beauty.
I'm about culture. I get a little confused with the word beauty because I never understood it when they throw it at me and ask me questions about it. But culture, society, that's what I'm about. I'm about trying to make sure the people understand that this is how we live. Let's not make it a Woody Allen movie. Let's clarify that we need to integrate. And so I knew what I needed to do, and I couldn't take everyone on because the other agencies were starting to tell white kids when their parents and them came to interview with different agencies, they started saying, well, she's really great because everyone could not say nothing but great things about me. But they would do this clever thing by saying, but, you know, she usually just works with blacks. If they saw too many, I always had more than them. And she tends to lean towards this one. If they saw me working hard on Rishumba or Veronica, they'd use it. And that would make the potential model hesitate, maybe. So I couldn't push it any further because by the time they get to me, they would tell me these stories. They would say, well, you know, they told us, is this true? Here we go. So I had to watch it. I had to keep a balance. But seeing that these other girls were going to other agencies and working, so I wanted to celebrate them and let them know there's a big thing with homelessness going on right now that I'm on. And I want to do something about homelessness. And I want to do a big party, but I want them all to come together and make it happen. But I want to show everybody who these girls are. And I want to show these girls how they can use their celebrity to do better things for others. And I want them to see that they can work with each other. Just women alone, just being black. It was a triple trifecta of intention. It was really a great thing. I'm very proud of that. The way my mind often works, you know, I'm always trying to figure it out, but I like the way that I pulled that one off. And a lot of people think that Black Girls Coalition was about a racial thing. It wasn't. It was a racial thing in the end. I was using race to sort of educate people about another story. It was about homelessness. But I wanted you to see all those black girls because they were what was happening at that time. So it's a way to, it's like a slow roll. Yeah. It was interesting.
And you were also at the same time navigating so much racism within the industry. In preparing for this interview, I read this 1997 Newsweek article that you're quoted in. It's about the model Alec Weck, and it noted some African Americans complain that Weck is a demeaning stereotype of black features, wide nose, full lips, natural hair, and ultra dark skin. Ironically, at a time when many African Americans thirst for African culture, some are suspicious of Weck's fame.
I didn't say that right.
No, you didn't. But I was really kind of shocked in reading this article that this is 1997. This is 25 years ago. And that was where the culture was at.
Yeah. You mean that there were divisions in how one is looked at the other? Oh, yeah. That's forever. That will be. I was going to say something so stupid, but that's silly. No, it wasn't surprising. Look what happened when Iman came. Do you think that Black America was happy about this person called Peter Beard finds this girl in the jungle and she's bringing him all the way from Africa to bring him to America? Do you know there were people in Essence, I mean, the editor-in-chief of Essence magazine was completely infuriated by this idea when there's so many good-looking girls in Chicago. What are you going to bring somebody all the way from the quote-unquote bush and get all this notoriety? It was offensive. She took the hit, too, because by the time they did this big press conference and all, it was like, what? You kidding me? And playing like she doesn't speak English. So that was back then. That was in the 70s. So when someone like Alec Weck comes along, when you get, you know, rid of most of the girls and you start looking at this and this is being like the look and it's only like a look, yeah, it could be offensive because, you know, within the culture, within the race, there's so much culture, but there's also within the race, there's so much diversity. And so that becomes a little offensive to people, understandably. But in the end of the day, it's getting better for many because the division is becoming less for the people of a certain race, surely for Asians, for Black Americans, for the, oh my God, Native Americans, because they're still having their battle to be recognized. But we're now, because we're getting so much play, we're coming together more in strength and not looking at one or the other as being lesser. And look at what's happening with West African models. So many are coming in. Whether the image is right or not is only because of what we've done. So sometimes I worry that we run so far in some direction that we're going to lose what we're really trying to gain, which is complete diversity. Because oftentimes we have a habit, the industry, of making something a trend, going so far in one direction that what you find out saying is that they get bored. Because we are a creative environment. And you have to stay creative, you have to sort of like swing your head another direction. And so what happens, you wonder, well, all right, here we go. I want them to be inclusive of more Blacks, but now they're going to just go right to one continent, which is a continent, and do. But are you still remembering there's blondes and brunettes? Because I don't want you to get so, like, because you can, their minds can go, oh, well, that was a nice moment. Yeah. And just go in a different direction.
And if you go to 1984 when you started this, that was your whole MO.
Yeah. Yeah. That's very true. When you say my whole MO, you mean in regards to?
Diversity.
Diversity.
And celebrating.
Yeah. Well, first of all, I've worked in a white world. I'm always someone who never lost my way. I'm Lady Chaplin's, you know. I never stopped knowing who I am. I chose a school to go to. I went to the garment business to get work. I'm used to being integrated within a white world. But at the same time, my foot is on the clutch. My hand is on the gun. I know exactly that I'm here to bring in and to integrate. And so in the end of the day, I'm the quiet storm that's going to make sure that things change in some way because that's my job. That's what I come here to do. Whether I know it or not, I see it. I've seen it. I mean, now I'm also learning who I am. I'm also, as I say that Frederick often, I'm a fly on my own wall. That's what I want to be. You know, I'm watching things saying, wow, look at that. What, look at how this over, you know? So you understand that there's a thing that is going well right now in so many ways. That's on the image of models, but also now with designers, entrepreneurs of design, of fashion design, trying to help them. And making sure that we don't get selected just because we have color, because that doesn't help us. We have to get selected because we're superior. we're equal to the best. We can run alongside of our white counterparts. That's more important than anything. And if we don't get that, we'll only fall backwards. If we get selected because we're black and they're just trying to check a box because they can't help it, we're putting pressure on them to do it. So now then they do it. Don't you get mad at them because they're doing it. We have to sort of like help them to balance it. It's a certain education. People have to be told, don't just put everybody in because the 15% pledge is being put so far on you that you don't even recognize how you should handle the 15%. I use that as a great example that Aurora created, the 15% pledge, because at the end of the day, there is something to that philosophy, but it's how those people who have to do it, how they use it. Did I out-talk you?
No. A lot to think about, obviously. In 2013, you started the Diversity Coalition, and this was really a way of holding people accountable. You took certain fashion labels to task for not including black models in their runway shows, and in a letter to the CFDA and other national and international fashion organizations, you wrote, if you use one or two models consistently for one or two, three seasons of color, or none, the result, no matter the intention, is racism. And you named a laundry list of these guilty parties, including brands many people would know, Celine, Donna Karan, Marc by Marc Jacobs, The Row. Looking back on it now, nearly a decade later, how do you see things have changed? What would you say the impact has been?
No, it was immediate. I mean, internationally, it was immediate. Because I sent the letter out the first day of New York Fashion, almost Fashion Week. But it gave time to the international market to do something about it. So they had almost a few weeks. And Celine was one of the first ones. You know, of course, Miuccia Prada had done something. You know, she put the young girl of color in her ad. And that was like, oh, because she was the one who made it all be the way it was. You know, she was the one who was a lead horse taking the girl of glamour, the girl of color, the girl of fashion glamour off the runway. She was the one who was supportive of the Eastern European girl being the runway model that was the image. Because of that, and when she then, almost 10 years later, put this girl, that was good because she was the lead horse. But to see Celine, who had never used, I mean, Phoebe is a great girl, Phoebe Philo, but she had never even used an Asian girl. She never used anyone of color. And when that letter went out, that little wonderful girl with the little afro came, and I was like, well, here we go. And then, you know, you watch everyone. And in the British Vogue, and I'll give Natalie Messonnier a lot of credit because they were the first ones, the only ones out of the four cities that responded immediately, you know, the British Fashion Council, that they wanted to do something. But to watch someone like Armani open the show with the girls of color, you know, and close it, everybody responded, which it was really wonderful to watch.
And now, where do you see things?
And it opened the door. It kept the door open. People basically just, no one's closed it. There was a moment, sure, in the beginning that the first year, two, you would watch it, you know, they go, we're going up, 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 up. And then they go, which meant that they sort of like leveling off, but they would level off and start dropping the feeling of diversity. And then I'd get a call, like Edward Enifo would call me, said, because I used to use the coalition as my temperature. They would read, because I couldn't see everything. I wasn't going to the shows, but they would give me the reading. There were different people, whether it be models. The people who are behind me are really people that's everything in the industry. So they would give me their take. Some girls would be at a show and they could see what wasn't happening. There would be some editors. There'd be some hair and makeup people. They would tell me what's happening. And that was all I had because I was the one who wrote the letter. And I was the only one. I had the backup band, but I was up front and center. I was a front band, right? So it was interesting to me to watch it. Sometimes it would start to go down. And we had Franca Sozzani, too. That's another person, you know, that was very important for you to...
2008, you did the all-black issue.
That's right. Oh, you know everything. So they... what am I talking to him for? but the idea really was that you could see that you had to really, you know, keep your foot on the clutch. It was like driving a, you know, a standard car. You know, this was not automatic. You had to really just watch the gears and shift and shipment, you know, seeing things that they weren't staying steady. They would say, okay, well, we did that. And they would slow down. We go, uh-oh. And you worried. We worried for a long time. I did. I mean, I worried because I just know that you're talking to human creatives. You're talking about something that you might make them feel like they're being made to do. Are they being inclusive naturally? When are they going to embrace it and just get it? We don't have to be part. We don't have to be 50%. Just make sure it looks like you get it. It could be 30%. It could be 20%. But just don't make it 2%. Just embrace. And so it was worrisome. But now they're in a direction I'm going to say, okay, we can lean a little bit better.
I mean, George Floyd lit the fuse.
Well, that's it, what I'm saying. Bless you for saying it, because the death of this gentleman, the movement just spilled right over into fashion. So it starts changing everything, and not only just in fashion, just everything from corporate, you know, C-suites. There are people sitting there who could do the job that you're just ignoring because they just never were there before, so you're not paying them any attention. You're staying in your lane. And, you know, eventually you'll see that, especially Black women, they could really do the job and still breastfeed you without you noticing it. Because
I want to finish the interview there, actually, because, yeah. You know, we just had Ketanji Brown Jackson.
Yeah.
And we're also in a moment of incredible Black women leaders, Stacey Abrams,
yeah.
Kamala Harris.
Yeah.
How do you feel about seeing all these incredible, impressive, beyond worthy Black women in these positions of power and leadership? And what do you see for the future?
On a political note, it's really great in that sense. But when you grow up in where how I grew up, you're so used to seeing and being exposed to Black women who were successful to you, whether they were just housewives or mothers or people who were always at the school. To me, I'm always used to seeing. My mother was so cool. And that's why I sometimes call her girl. I never called her mom. I always called her Sophie, because my mother was a complete example of someone who lived to the end. So when you get to this place, when you start seeing other people doing great things, some of the greatest, Bessie Smith from Sarah Vaughan. I mean, those are people to me that were just like what's happening now for this generation of people, you know, watching a Kamala Harris get to be vice president. But we worked a lot hard to get these things to change, you know. The Panthers and the SNCC and all those kids, those boys were all college kids. And so for me, I'm so used to seeing things in motion. These are great results. I'm still worried about my country's democracy, but I'm very proud of a lot of entertainers and a lot of people who really basically behind the scenes that we don't even know are running corporations right now. They're not the shiny ones, but they're the ones who are capable of doing it. So for me, I know that within the ether, I'm really part of something, of things that are really happening. Fortunately and unfortunately, I'm not part of the corporate world. The reason why I say fortunately is because I can swing a stick any kind of way I want and not feel any abuse. I could wear dreads as long as I wanted to. I could do anything because I grew up in the garment business and I was part of an industry called fashion. And I came along at a time that was very easy to be a woman of color. To me, I still think of my industry as a woman's business. I don't care how many men are successful in it right now and are getting the collaborations. But the truth of it is, it's still a woman's business, and I recognize that strongly. I think no matter what color a woman is, if she's not part of maybe Dixie, if she's not below the line in the South that she's gotten lost and she's sticking with the Confederate flag, she's very powerful. Any woman is right now. And to now to see, for me, it would have been a real defeat if they hadn't made the Supreme Judge the Supreme Judge. It would have been a defeat because she was worthy. And these guys are really reminding you how bad they are. Bad meaning not good bad, but bad bad. And so I'm so happy that she really got nominated. And it's become a success. I'm happy for Joe Biden because in the end of the day, it wasn't just because he was trying to make sure I do something that I said I was going to do. It was just for the fact that this is the guy. I've always been, you know, that's why he got in, because a lot of the old black people know who he is. You know, a lot of other people don't know, and they're not going to give him any kind of break, because this is the world we live in right now. We live in on the internet life, you know, so I'm very proud of that. But I know we are in very tsunami type waters.
And just on a very personal level, how do you feel about tomorrow?
Tomorrow as a future. Yeah. Yeah, I'm worried. I really am. I'm worried. Politically, I'm very worried. I mean, I never thought I would want to leave my country for any reason. You know, I came up at a time where we just fought for things, and you watched us succeed, and you watched a lot of people who cared. We saw the progress of our country, mine, my country, America. I saw the progress. And so now I don't see that. I see it. The division is so thick, and the power of one person. And then you start seeing other countries at the same temperature. Other people are doing the same thing. It's autocrat, you know, could become a little fascist in a way. So I'm thinking, I never thought I'd run. I never thought I would, you know, not really completely. I never thought I would see how is it going to make a difference, because I see the tsunami about to happen. So I'm concerned about that, and thinking, where could I put my last years? Because I don't know how much I can change things myself, except for what I can do in my neighborhood. No one in politics cares anything about fashion, because they don't think that we're thinking, so they don't care. So I'm just going to stay in that lane as best as I can, and throw some money to Beto and a couple other people I know that I just like. You know, I mean, go Beto, beat them if you can in Texas. But in the end of the day, there are not many people. I mean, throw some dollars out, few dollars out. Stacey, got to get some, you know, keep Georgia alive if you can. You know, those are things you just got to do, just so, like you would if you recycle. Do the right thing, you know, to help our world. And so for that, I'm really kind of concerned. And for the rest of it, I wish that parents would just take care of their children in a better way and stop making their self-esteem and just stop building them up with so much elitedness. And people are getting very lazy. That's what I'm getting ready to say. People don't want to work no more. I mean, this is scary. I listen to the radio. I don't listen to Oprah. I listen to the radio. And I'm telling you, they're saying, well, if I can't have this and I can't, it's getting very, So that said, I just wish everyone well, and I'm glad I'm older.
And I'm glad you came in today. Thanks,
thank you so much. Thank you so much. You've been wonderful, really wonderful.
Extra thanks to our Season 5 sponsor, Le Cole School of Jewelry Arts, which is supported by the Maison Van Cleef & Arpels. A unique place for learning, Le Cole welcomes the general public to the world of jewelry through courses, conferences, exhibitions, videos, and book publications. You can find out more about Le Cole at www.lecolevancleefarpels.com. That's www.lecolevancleefarpels.com. And thank you for listening. You can find more episodes of Time Sensitive on our website, timesensitive.fm, or wherever you listen to podcasts. You can listen to our other podcast, At a Distance, by heading to atadistancepodcast.com. You can follow us on Instagram at slowdown.tv. And if you like our program, please be sure to subscribe and leave comments. Our theme music was composed by Billy Martin. This episode was produced by Emily Jang, Tiffany Zhao, Mike Lala, and Johnny Simon.